Hopefully today we're going to conclude the 12th principle. Ani mamin be'emuna shleima be'vias ha-Mashiach. I believe with perfect faith, complete faith in the coming of Mashiach. V'aval pi shiyisma me'an, even though he may tarry. In kol ze'achak eloi. Nonetheless, I will wait for him b'chol yom every day, sheyavoi, that he might come. The Gemara in Sukkah, in the middle of Nun Beis Amud Aleph, says as follows. Tana Rabbana, our sages taught us, Mashiach ben David she'asid lehigolish b'mher v'yomeinu, that Mashiach of the line of David, who is destined to be revealed speedily in our time. Eimalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the master of the world, blessed be he, says to him, Sha'al mimeni dava ve'atein lecha, ask me anything and I'll give it to you. Shenemar, as it says in Tehillim, Asapra al chayk, Ani hayom yelidaticha, Hashem says to Mashiach, I have given birth to you this day. Sha'al mimeni vet negoim nachal sechel. Ask of me and I will give nations to you as your inheritance. Kivan shera'a, Mashiach ben Yosef shenerag, Mashiach ben David will take note of the death of Mashiach of the line of Yosef, who has been killed. Eimel Afonov, so Mashiach ben David says to Hashem, Ribbono shel Olam, Master of the World, Eini mevakesh mimcha lechayim. I ask of you nothing other than life. Here was Mashiach, Mashiach ben Yosef. And he was this very powerful leader. And he was assassinated. He was killed. So I ask of you nothing more than life. Eimalei, so Hashem responds to him, Chaim ad shelo yamata. This request that you make for life, even before you made this request, Kvar hisnabi alecha David avicha. Your forefather, your ancestor David, already prophesied, Shenema Chaim shoal mimcha nasatalei. He asks of you life, but you have already given him life. It's evident then from this Gemara that when we speak of the fact that we believe in the coming of Mashiach, that there are a number of stages to this coming of Mashiach, and that in addition to the Mashiach that we generally think of, Mashiach ben David, that there's another Mashiach who comes before Mashiach ben David, and that is Mashiach ben Yosef. And this Mashiach ben Yosef, who is obviously is a very powerful figure, this Mashiach ben Yosef is going to be killed. So we need to understand the function of these two Mashiachs. And we need to understand why it takes place in this fashion. My remarks in the largest measure today are based on a variety of commentaries by the individual who, amongst Chassidim, especially amongst Polish Chassidim, was referred to as the Kayan. And this refers to Reb Tzadik HaKayan, who was an incredibly brilliant Torah genius, in addition to being a Tzadik of mammoth proportions. And throughout his many written works, there are comments, which all of which seem to lead in a single direction. And while much of this is my own interpretation and elaboration, they are based upon Reb Tzadik's comments. There are other comments by some of the other Svarim HaKadoshim which are consistent with Reb Tzadik's basic theme. And this represents something of an integration of all of this. Let's go into the purpose of two Mashiachs. We have a general rule. That rule is Seif Maaseh Machshava Tchila. The last thing which is done is the very first thought. And in that statement there are really two parts. The most common understanding that we have of that is, for example, we think of a chair. And we have this image, this design, this picture in front of our eyes and in front of our imagination of a chair. We then, in an effort to bring this image into reality, we then begin to take some, to back off of that image and begin to ask ourselves, how do we get this chair? So we go through such things as we want to make sure that we know exactly what size, the measurements, what shape, how many legs, what color, what materials we want to use to make it of. We're going to make it of wood, we're going to make it of metal, we're going to make it of plastic, we're going to make it of... who is that? It's your friend. Is that it? Of whatever that wicker stuff is. I mean, you can make a chair out of a whole variety of different materials. You need to think of what tools you'll need. So you think about the tools. You need to think of all the different places where you're going to have to go shopping and how much money it's going to take to get it. And you just keep on working through. You record all of the different details. And as you work through the details, you then discover what else you'll need. And finally, you then go through all of the different steps of actually procuring these different materials, the paint, the material, the tools, and so on. And then you go through a series of steps trying to do whatever are the first basic elements of building this thing. And you end up with perhaps, whatever, sanding it and then varnishing it. You finish the chair. What you end up with was your first thought. You end up with this chair, which is a reflection of the very first picture that you had. Seif Maaseh, the very last thing that you complete was your machshava tchila, was your first thought. After you had your first thought, you then have to analyze it and break it down and separate it into all kinds of smaller parts so that you could bring this last thing into being. That's the first part of Seif Maaseh Machshava Tchila. But there is a second machshava, which is a realization of this thought that the last thing is the first thought, and that is the function, which is that after you've brought the chair into being, you go over and you sit down on it, which is really the motive that created the picture of the chair in the first place. So there was a machshava to the machshava. There was first a machshava, gee, I would like to be able to sit on something. Then that created another machshava, which is the picture of the chair. This would be something that would take care, that would fulfill my desire, my machshava to sit. So when you sit down, you then fulfill the very earliest machshav, which was the propelling force behind the picture. In a certain sense, that's the machshava l'machshava, or what we might call the pnimius haratzon, the very innermost thought, the very innermost will or desire. The world also has two parts, two dimensions of seif maise machshava tchila. One is a world. There is an image, a world in which there is such a thing as choice, a being who will be capable of exercising choice, a world in which there will be good and evil, a world in which this being will prevail over evil, will conquer evil, and thereby will establish the unchallenged sovereignty of the Almighty in the world. So such a world requires such things as a human being, Adam, Chava, Gan Eden. It requires a Nachash. It requires someone who bears the purpose of challenging the integrity of Adam and Chava. And ultimately, all the tests and trials and tribulations of history. Bringing the world to this destination, to the point where the Nachash is overcome, where evil is banished, and the absolute sovereignty of the Almighty is revealed, the Hizgalus of Malchus Shemayim, that is the end picture which God had in mind. And the Seif Maisa, this thing which is taking thousands of years to reach this point where evil will be overcome and exposed as futility, as emptiness, as betrayal, as deceit, and nothing else will predominate other than the clear and unquestioned absolute will and sovereignty of the Almighty. That's the end. That's the end of this picture that God had at the beginning of creation.
So, and the part with the world and man was really three steps up. There's the world, and then there's man, then there's the perfection of that.
Well, the world really, I'm using here the world's including man. Mm-hmm. But the purpose of creation is that after this is achieved, that as a result of all of the toil and all of the standing up to trial and test and suffering and misery acting according to one's conscience and so on throughout the history of the long and tortured history of mankind, the end is that when this point is reached, that there has been achieved a level of such perfection that man can therein or thereafter enter into this most intimate relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the end, really, the real end is, the function of all of this is so that at the end God can reach out and embrace man in this ecstasy of a divine intimacy. That's the end. We have the chair, so now we're going to sit down in it. The end of reaching this point is so that when you've reached that point, or when mankind has reached that point, when history is finally moved to this point in history, that thereafter, then man and God are united in this ever-growing, ever more intense, ever more rewarding and fulfilling relationship, which is the divine embrace that waits for man at the end of history. And that's really the pnimius of Ratzon. It was that Ratzon, it was that will, it was that thought, it was that interest in in having this relationship with mankind that brought the picture into being in the first place. So that is the primus haratzon, and that's the innermost thought. So here too we have two levels. We have a thought and an end, and then we have the thought to the thought, and the end to the end. Now we have two protagonists in history that help us move through these different chapters. One is Leah, and one is Rachel. One is Yehuda, who is the child of Leah, and one is Yosef, who is a child of Rachel. And Israel, Bnei Yisrael, Klal Yisrael, are known either as in total, in other words, all of the tribes and all the descendants of the tribes are either known as Yehudim or Bnei Yehuda. We either carry the name of Yehuda or we carry the name of Yosef or Ephraim, as the case may be, because in reality we all are part of this greater tapestry, which requires these two main thrusts, in which we participate in one case in the thrust of Yosef and eventually in the thrust of Yehuda, or Mashiach ben David. The ultimate goal is the victory over evil, to replace the deceit, the appearance that evil rules the world, this illusion that evil prevails over it, by the way, which it happens to be a pretty strong illusion in our time, with a world in which it's manifest that the Almighty is the ruler and the absolute sovereign. That the Nachash and all of the appearances of the Nachash, all of the appearances of evil in history, are no longer a force, that the illusion has been penetrated, and they are gone. I believe it is Reb Tzadik who points out that for this reason that the name Mashiach itself really stands in direct challenge to Nachash. They both share in common two letters, the Ches and the Shin of Nachash are also found in Mashiach. There's a Ches and a Shin. The two letters in which they differ is one is a Nun and the other one has a Mem and a Yud, which really equal one another. Mem and Yud equal 50, and the Nun equals 50. So really, Mashiach is the counterforce to the Nachash and ultimately the victor over Nachash. Leah is the first one to bear children out of all of Yaakov's wives, and Rachel is the very last to bear children out of all of Yaakov's wives. And that really is more than just a coincidence in the way in which those births took place. Yosef is the one who wraps up history. It's kind of, Yosef is the last act in history. Mashiach ben Yosef is the culminating activity, the culminating battle of history. Whereas Yehuda really represents the beginning of a new era, a new chapter, a new world. So Mashiach ben David ushers in a new world consistent with Leah's bearing children first, and the Mashiach ben Yosef closes the last chapter of history. Yosef or Mashiach ben Yosef, or the entire line of Yosef, works his magic generally or predominantly in history in the month of Adar. Reb Tzadik points to the fact that that Yosef is the only one of the Shvatim, the only one of the tribes, who splits into two parts. He is the progenitor of Ephraim and Manasseh, both of whom become tribes. No other tribe has this capacity to create tribes. And the month of Adar is the only month which can split into two in the calendar. No other month has this privilege of being repeated or having two parts to it. Yehoshua, who is of the line of Yosef, rises to leadership in the month of Adar because Moshe Rabbeinu dies on Zion Adar. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu passes away on the seventh day of Adar, and that is the day in which Yehoshua becomes the next manhig of Klal Yisrael. And of course, Mordechai, who is of the line of Yosef, the line of Benjamin, works his magic, rises to power in Adar. And the Svarim HaKadoshim point out that at the end of history, Mechias HaMolek, the destruction, the ultimate destruction of Amalek, which will take place through the force of Yosef, that will take place in the month of Adar, whereas the appearance of Mashiach ben David and the Geula Shlema, the complete redemption, takes place in the month of Nisan, which is the beginning of a new chapter, and it's HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Reish Chodashim. That's the beginning of our calendar. Yosef's function is one of Sur Mira. It's one of excising and eradicating evil. Mechias Hara, Mechias HaMolek, the destruction of Esav. Whereas Yehuda's function is a world which is already been liberated from the power of evil and marks an unbroken climb to excellence. His function is essentially that of Asei Tov, of leading the world, guiding the world to the ever-increasing levels of excellence. Reb Tzadik also points to the fact that in Yehuda's name, you have the entire name of Hashem. There's a Dalet in there, which makes it Yehuda, but otherwise all of the other letters of Yehuda's name are the name that we never pronounce, but we always read it. It's Yud Kei Vod Kei. Yosef, we are told, had a hey added to his name, so his name became Yehoisef. And there you have three letters of Hashem's name, but not the entire name, because Yosef is the force which completes history, but is not the realization of history. And so in a certain sense, you have Yosef, who appears at the winter of history, whereas Yehuda opens up the spring of a new era in the history of the world. Reb Tzadik also points out a very, very interesting distinction. He says that the essence of Yosef is action. And inasmuch as we live in a world of action, and our challenge is to bring into this world of commerce, the world in which we live and act, in which we're called upon to do battle with pedestrian things, that Yosef's arch rival is Esav. And the word Esav itself represents the word ma'aseh. The same letters make up the word asu, to do, to complete. And Esav was born complete. He was fully, as it were, acted upon. And it's Yosef's responsibility in his essence to fulfill this responsibility of bringing Kedusha, of bringing sanctity, of bringing God's Rotzen, God's will, into the world of action. To banish or to repress the forces of evil in this world of action. And he says that this represents, our sages comment, that Derech Eretz is Kadma L'Derech. That there is the earthy world, the world in which is full of Atzius, it's full of commonplace things, secular things, profane things, pedestrian things, mundane things, moribund things, a world which calls upon us to act within it. And in that world, there's a derech, there is a way. What do we call the kinds of things that we do when we are walking? The act of walking is halicha, and the clues that we have how to walk on this derech is called halacha. We are walking on this derech, and derech eretz, it's incumbent upon us to fight this battle of Yosef alongside Mashiach ben Yosef in order to pave the way for a world in which tzaddikim yoshvim v'atreisim rasheim, in which there will be a world in which mankind will be able to communicate, will be able to unite with Hashem in Torah, in the wisdom, in the intimacy of Torah. And so, it is Mashiach ben Yosef who completes this defeat, who soundly defeats Esav, Gog u'Magog, all of these forces of war, of power, of keichi v'etzem yodi, my hand, my power, my might. And it is Yosef and Mashiach ben Yosef who paves the way for Yehuda, for Mashiach ben David to come in and to lead the world in its pursuit of Hashem's Rotzen as manifest in the Seydes, in the secrets and the mysteries of Torah. And we find that same thing taking place in the early part of the story of the family of Yaakov. First, Yosef goes down to Egypt. Ervas Oretz, he goes into this culture which is steeped with immorality. And in the midst of that immorality, Yosef creates an island of sanctity. He demonstrates all of the discipline that's necessary to stand up against all of this evil. And he remains Yosef HaTzadik. And afterwards, the Pasuk tells us, Ves Yehuda Sholach Lefonov El Yosef, that Yaakov dispatches Yehuda, Lahiris Lefonov Geshna, to create a yeshiva, to create a Mukim Torah. What we need perhaps to understand, and there is a very engaging, a very intriguing and fascinating piece by Reb Tzadik in one of the Svarim, in which he describes to some extent these two functions in very, very different terms. And essentially the question is, why is Yosef called upon to complete history and Yehuda to usher in this new season, this new dimension of history? So to that end, I'd like to use a parable. As most parables, there is a king. The king has two sons. And they're both very talented and very gifted, but they have two very different temperaments. One son is very strong-willed, very disciplined. He has a mind that's steeled to think, to analyze, to question, to probe, to reason, to conclude, to act inductively, to act deductively, and to carry these things out. Extremely disciplined temperament. Reasons in a very compelling, a very cogent way, and then acts upon that reasoning with an unwavering force of character. It's an intellect that's sharply honed to be able to deal very, 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 very clearly, very firmly, very forcefully with the world. The other one has a very, very different temperament. His temperament is one which is very intuitive, very profound, very passionate, very deep, very busy, not so much with the laws of things as you find them, but very busy with the mysteries that lie behind them. The first son deals with all challenges, all temptations, with an iron will and prevails. He remains uncorrupted, uncompromised, unsullied. The second son is restless. He's driven by this passion to know things in the core and the depths of their existence. And he wants to know what drives the kingdom, what drives people, what makes up all of the forces of this domain, which his father over which his father rules. And so, defiance of all of his father's warnings, this restless son goes out into the world. And discovers a very coarse, a very violent, a very vulgar world, a world which is wretched, a world which is tormented, it's just full of pain and deceit and corruption and lust and ambition and avarice and greed and all kinds of similar distasteful phenomena. And in a very oblique fashion, he tastes of these forces. And he comes to understand the void and the emptiness and the deceit and the betrayal of these forces. How they destroy, how they rot those people who bear them, those people who participate in them. And from this great distance, he comes to appreciate the luster of the palace, the wisdom of the law, the profundity of the perspective, the warmth of his father's love. And so he returns to the palace, and with extraordinary remorse and regret is restored to a relationship with the king. Son number one has always been in good standing. Son number one has an ongoing relationship with light, has not tasted of darkness, has resisted darkness, has a strong bond with the king. But son number two has a bond with the king which transcends that of his brother, because he's tasted of the darkness, because he knows what lies outside the palace, because he understands the wisdom of his father's discipline. And there doesn't go by a moment that he doesn't seek his father's embrace, that he doesn't seek his father's company and companionship, that he doesn't bask in the warmth and in the wisdom of his father, every moment appreciating how how extraordinarily blessed he is because he has seen and tasted what the rest of the world is all about, and he knows what darkness is all about. His love of light, his appreciation of light, his cherishing of light is one which is derived from darkness. It's not merely a comparison of light and darkness, but it is an appreciation which is born of darkness. And to that extent, the king who sees the intensity of the compelling force of this child's love recognizes that the child has transformed this experience into one which now enables him to appreciate a relationship in a way in which the child number one, son number one, can never really appreciate it. Every moment is modified by that experience with darkness. Reb Tzadik says that the strength of Rachel's children lies in their ability to live disciplined lives, to repress, to overcome, to triumph over evil. Yosef flees his temptress. Binyamin is described as one of the four people who never sinned. Eliyahu Hanavi is one of these unblemished individuals whose sterling discipline makes him the individual who enters Gan Eden in a fiery chariot alive, never experiences death. Shaul HaMelech, who is the one who comes before David HaMelech, is of the children of Rachel, and is described by the pasuk as being like a one as has the innocence and the blamelessness of a one-year-old child. Mashiach ben Yosef's function is to stand up to the nations of the world, to use the force of a tzaddik gomer, of being a perfect, of being a complete tzaddik. And this is called, this act of overcoming evil, of confronting evil and standing up to it, is called in the terms of the Kabbalists as eskafia. It's called by force of character, by force of integrity, by force of will, suppressing evil, overcoming evil, championing evil, being the champion over evil. It's called eskafia. From, what's the Hebrew word, Ruben? Is that a Hebrew word? Lakuf? Lakuf to force. Kafia. To be kafa. Kafin on me the stone. Huh? Huh? That's right. I think the root word would be kuf pei hei. That's a kuf pei hei. But our Chazal tell us that b'mokeim shebali tshuva imdin ein tzadikim molim b'cheron lamed. That the place to which bali tshuva, those who have entered the world of darkness and have returned from it in a particular way, that the place to which they can ascend, a tzaddik gomer, cannot reach that place. It's not accessible to them. And if I understand Reb Tzadik correctly, the force of Yehuda, Mashiach ben David, is the force of transforming evil. Not eskafia, standing off evil. Not the force of Yosef fleeing his temptress. But rather, it's the capacity to, having lived to some extent in whatever oblique fashion, and tasted of the darkness of the world, to do something which is called eshafcha, which is to transform the darkness into light. The yisrein ha'ayr, the advantage, the excellence of the light, min ha'cheshech, is fashioned of the darkness itself. It said of David HaMelech, Ne'um ha'gever hukam ol, that David HaMelech is the one who raised up the pillar of tshuva in the world. He is the one who was able to create this metamorphosis of turning darkness to light. In taking a situation in which the very distance which he perceived himself to be at became this very driving and intense force in the ardor of his relationship with Hashem Yisbach. So, when Mashiach ben Yosef completes his work of choosing, of bechira, of standing up to evil, such that he overcomes Gog Magog, he overcomes all of the forces which culminate in this epic battle and Mashiach ben Yosef's victory. We have this point where now evil is finally decisively defeated. The Ribbono Shel Olam extirpates evil from the world. There is now a yichud, a tremendous kiddush Hashem, which has taken place under Mashiach ben Yosef, in which it is now clear absolutely that there is only one sovereign over the universe, and that is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And there is now this new chapter which is opened up, in which Mashiach ben David comes with all of the accumulation of our experience in history and fighting all of these battles, and it is now all of these battles with evil now becomes this tremendous driving force in a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in which the darkness is not merely been defeated, but it now is transformed into a relationship of incredible appreciation of the light, which we experience from that point forward as we move through Nitzchius, as we move through eternity. We do so under the leadership of Mashiach ben David, who represents as hafcha, the transformation of darkness into light, of evil into something which really carries us into a relationship which is deepened by our having gone through what we went through.
Why does he need to die?
So the question is, why does Mashiach ben Yosef need to die? So Reb Tzadik has a lengthy description of that, which I thought was really going to be far beyond our time limits tonight. The Sfarim do point out that when Mashiach ben David comes, that the first thing that he will do will be to resurrect Mashiach ben Yosef. His first act will be to bring this fallen leader back to life. There is a story which I've shared with you in the past, which I think bears some repeating here, in as much as it really kind of captures one dimension of what we've been talking about. And I'll close with the story. There were two brothers, Rav Zish of Anapol and Rav Melech of Lezhensk. And the two of them were very close to one another and respected one another a great deal. And it's related that Rav Melech said to Rav Zish, he said to him, Zish, he said, our Sforim HaKadoshim, our sacred texts teach us that that in Adam, in Adam HaRishon, all of the souls of humanity inhered in Adam HaRishon when he was created. So that means, Zisha, that you and I, our neshamas, were also there. Our souls were also part of this great configuration called Adam. So he said, when the time came that Adam was tempted to eat of the Eitz Hadas, he said, that means that you and I participated. So he said, I can see where, because of the fact that I'm not the kind of person that I should be, that I would have succumbed. I too would have fallen for the temptation of the Nachash. He said, but you, Zish, he says, you're such an honest person. He said, you're so consistent. How is it possible that you didn't protest? Why didn't you lift your voice wherever you were in this configuration of Adam? Why didn't you like give him a little shtach and say, no, you can't do this? Why didn't you let it happen? So Zisha said to him, look, he said, you have to think of it this way. He says, it's almost as though the Nachash or evil was there with a clenched fist saying to Adam, you'll never believe what I have in here. He said, and I thought to myself, Zisha says, way back then at the beginning of time, I thought to myself, he said, I'll stop Adam. And what will happen is that Adam will spend the rest of his existence thinking, I wonder what he had in his hand. And to the extent that he will be so preoccupied, his devotion will be incomplete. So he says, so I decided I'm going to let him find out that when evil opens its hand, that there's nothing there. So he'll never have any problems. He'll never have any question.
Right.
But the point over here is that we go through this entire period of the development of the world of history, and it's a constant education. It's a constant illusion that there's something there, and at the end of time, when Mashiach ben Yosef comes to fight this battle, the hand is opened up, and we see in ways which are incontrovertibly clear that we've been dealing with an illusion that the hands of evil have been empty all along. But our capacity at that point to be appreciative of what it means to be able to live within a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is redoubled by our experiences, by our trials and tribulations with the forces of evil. And to that extent, this eskafya yields to eshafcha. And it is no longer a standoff, the victory over a greater force, over a lesser force, but it is the opening of the hand and the revelation that there is no other force there, that there is only one dominion, there is only one monarch, there is only one sovereign force in the universe. And at that point, Mashiach ben David carries Klal Yisrael through this culminating chapter, or the beginning of this new chapter of history, in which we enter into this relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in which there is no Yetzer Hara, in which there is no temptation, in which there is no evil. But there is an aspiration for excellence and an appreciation of excellence, which is born of our struggles in history.